Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Women's Wednesday here on Mind Talk. Every Wednesday, you and I have the opportunity to meet a woman who has agreed to share her story with us. And today, I'm going to start with just sharing with you a quote from someone who reviewed A Joyful Life, which is by Michelle Swiderski. And Tom Harper says that this is a refreshingly honest, firsthand grappling with one of the most insidious afflictions of our time. This is not about theory, but a painful, raw struggle and how Michelle Swiderski saved her own life using a constructive, hands-on approach. Michelle Swiderski, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you so much for having me, Pamela. I really appreciate the invitation.
Well, I have to say that the subtitle of your book, which is How to Use Your Creative Spirit to Manage Depression. You know, depression is perhaps one of the most common experiences that people have. And certainly it shows up in a range of ways with a range of symptoms. But it's also something, as you point out in A Joyful Life, that very often people don't want to talk about, don't know how to talk about, are afraid to talk about. So I would like for you to begin with just talking about what it was like for you as you began to experience sort of this downward spiral of depression.
Of course. I had two quite different experiences of depression. I'll tell you about the first, which happened in 2002. It was actually what used to be called a nervous breakdown. And I go into the reasons why in the book, but at that moment, I had no idea why. I just knew that my body stopped functioning. I should say my brain stopped functioning. I was just in a panic. I was at work. I was pacing. I just had no idea what to do. Anyway, I made my way home and I realized that I was in a very deep depression. That came, from what I could tell, just completely out of the blue. And it was a very dark place. I made my way to my general practitioner, to my doctor, and he, you know, started helping me. So that was my first experience and the worst experience of my life. Subsequent to that, so I was off for that period. I was off work about a year on medical leave. I just could not function. Subsequent to that, several years later, I had another episode of depression where I could see some signs of it in my life. And I could see that, this is happening again. So I had a little bit of forewarning there. So I was able to stop in my tracks, go to my doctor, get that process going again. And that time I was off work for about 6 or 7 months. The third time that it hit was in 2009 in the fall, and I was off work for a year again. But the third time I decided, and again, the signs and the symptoms and the anxiety and the fear and all these things that were, you know, triggers for myself, because people will experience different triggers, but for myself, I knew, here it comes. And that's when I decided I needed a different approach, because it's a fact that the more often people experience depression, the higher the likelihood that they will experience depression again and again. And statistically, and it's all well documented, statistically, I was on the third major episode, which meant that I was something like 90% sure of a recurrence, and then at that point, it would be 100% sure. You know what I'm saying?
It Absolutely.
Would just, it's incremental. So I knew that, and here I was in my third episode of depression, I'm thinking, no, I cannot allow this state to be the rest of my, the story of my life. Like, that can't happen. This is not acceptable. I'm not interested in doing that. I have to have a different approach, because clearly the old approach was just, you know, give me a reprieve for 2 or 3 years, and then it was a pattern here. So I am a person of a strong faith, and so I decided that I was going to engage spirit to guide me. And I remember this moment clear as a bell. I was looking in the hall mirror, and I could see myself, and I was talking to myself, but really I was talking to spirit, and I said, you are going to be in charge. I want a different experience. I don't want to keep repeating the same thing, and I haven't a clue how to do it. So I'm going to follow you, spirit, because the old way didn't work. It's up to you. So I'm following you, and you're in charge. And so then my job, as I saw it, was to really sharpen my senses. So my intuition. I started meditating every day, every morning, so that I would connect to the source directly. And so my spirituality became huge, and I paid attention like it was my life was at stake, because in fact, that's how I felt. And I paid attention to the signs, you know, how your intuition will tell you, no, turn left instead of right. And okay, I would do that. And it colored my life in a different light. And I learned so much during that year. I looked at that year as my healing, almost like a sabbatical from work, where I would learn how to heal and how to stay well. And if I couldn't do it during that year, well, that didn't even come into question in my mind. I just knew, you know, you don't question these things. When God is leading, you just follow. So that was my third experience of depression. So each one was different. Coming back to your question in terms of how I experienced depression, and I also became very, very open, willing to speak to anyone about what I was going through. And so... Yeah, well, does that answer your question?
It does, but it also brings up a lot of questions for me.
Okay.
So I'm going to go back a bit. One of the things that you said, which I would suggest for at least some listeners, is sort of a startling thing to think about. As you, as a result of the depression that you were experiencing, you were out of work for, not consistently, but you were out of work for large chunks of time, a year,
yes,
6 or 7 months, another
yes,
year. So big chunks. And I know that there are people who are hearing your conversation, hearing our conversation, and saying, well, I can't afford to be out of work for that kind of time. I just don't want to deal with it. I'm not going to the doctor. I will just somehow muddle through. What would you say to those folks with that perspective?
Well, a few things. One, because I was employed where there was medical coverage for a medical leave, I had a part of my salary while I was on leave. But the fact was that I wasn't able to function in my job. It wasn't a choice, nah, I think I need some time to regroup. That wasn't it. I wasn't able to function in my job. I couldn't think. I couldn't hear, like I couldn't understand people's questions. I would panic if the phone rang. I just didn't have a choice. I was on medical leave because I couldn't function in my work. And the second thing is that for folks who feel that it's an option, you know, that I'm feeling, and the other thing I wanted to say was when I was in depression, I didn't feel blue. I didn't feel like, just not feeling good today. It wasn't like that. It was my brain's not working.
Mm.
You know, I read, I don't remember. I can't even do groceries. I just I'm like a zombie. I'm walking and I just can't wait to get back in the house where it's safe. It's a different state of experiencing life. So I would just say that it wasn't a choice. And the other thing is, you know, if people are not willing or not prepared or they can't face having to take time off work, not to be, making people scared, but I have to say that my first episode of depression happened to me. I had a nervous breakdown. And why did this happen? Well, looking back, I understand that it was because I was not paying attention to those things that eventually put me over the edge. I was not listening to what my soul was screaming for attention, and I wasn't listening. So you don't always have a choice. It's like when you go, you're playing hockey or something and you break a leg. Oh, geez, no, I can't take time off work. Sorry, I can't break that leg. It doesn't work that way.
Too bad it doesn't work that way. It'd be great if it did.
Yeah, no.
You know, the other point that I would just like to underscore with respect to medical leave is that aside from the fact that it is there, first of all, you need to know that it's that your employer provides it. Presumably, it's there. In fact, factually, it's there for use if you actually need it. It's not as though you can wake up one morning, call into work and say, okay, I'm going to take medical leave for however long I feel like I might need it. It requires documentation. It requires that you meet with your doctor. So there are steps that you need to go through. But in fact, it's a lot better to take medical leave than to be fired.
And I feel really, really thankful, grateful that my employer had this program. Had I been self-employed, for example, who knows? You know,
yeah.
I could. I have no idea. I might be bankrupt today because you're having to foot the bill for all of that. I have no idea. But I was in that position where I was supported through my illness. So I'm very thankful for that.
There's another program or piece of a, what's the word that I'm looking for? An option, if you will, that many employers offer and that many employees either are not aware of or are afraid to access, and that is the Employee Assistance Program.
Mm-hmm.
You referenced that in your book, A Joyful Life. What was your experience with the Employee Assistance Program, and how did you access it?
It helped me a number of times, but not so much when I was in the thick of depression. It helped me when I was going through marital issues. So, the stresses of work, and it helped me, as I say, a few times. But when I was in the throes of depression, I didn't access it at that time. I was helped by others, another therapist, a cognitive behavior therapist, who was instrumental, really, really helpful to get me to view my choices as choices and not obligations. And she really helped me to look at my thinking, at my thoughts, and realize that, those are just thoughts. They're not reality. I can affect my reality with some thoughts that are more realistic. So I learned that during my depression, and that was really helpful. I still use that, you know, today. So, yeah, the EAP, I recommend it to people when I was still at work. I'm now recently retired, but when I was at work, yeah, a lot of people, it's interesting how they resist accessing that. And it's a social conditioning, I guess. Yeah, it's available to people, and it's an amazing resource. And again, feeling so lucky that my employer had a strong EAP program.
And the employee assistance program, when you access the services, they're confidential.
Totally. Totally confidential.
Even if your employer recommends you, which he or she doesn't, I mean, you can access it on your own.
Mm-hmm.
The whoever referred you is not going to be able to go back to the EAP program and say, okay, did she come in? What did she talk about? That's not part of it. It really is a confidential service, which includes short-term counseling if that's going to be useful. But they're just... I mean, it's designed to be exactly what it's named, employee assistance. If you've got something going on, you feel like you need to talk to somebody, there is somebody available to speak with on a confidential basis.
Correct.
Now, you just mentioned cognitive behavioral therapy. For those who may not be aware, give us more of a sense of what that experience was like for you. You talked about learning essentially how to think differently.
Absolutely. So it it came into play at different times in my experience. The more recent experience was once I had returned to work. I was having to kind of ramp up slowly. So they call that a job hardening program. So I was given, you know, more basic tasks, and this is something that I was able to negotiate, if you will, with my employer before coming in, before returning to work, so that I felt secure, and so the tasks were built up over time until the idea is that after a maximum of 6 months, you're then at your usual capacity in terms of work output and function. So I was in this program, in my home position, but in this program, and so I was working with my supervisor, and he, you know, wanted me to do a particular thing, and I was having trouble with it. I found that my brain was really sluggish. It wasn't working that strong, and I was doing it, but taking much, much longer than I used to, and of course, you know, human nature is that I compared my abilities to those that I had prior to the most recent episode, which is terribly unfair.
It's probably
of
one
myself.
Of the, yeah, it's probably one of the worst things you can do is to compare yourself to other people.
But
Michelle, we're
going
to take a break, and when we come back,
okay,
we're going to pick up right here. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk, and I'm having a conversation with Michelle Swiderski, who is the author of A Joyful Life, How to Use Your Creative Spirit to Manage Depression. We'll be right back. Michelle, just before the break, you were talking about the job hardening experience that you had as you returned to work. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah. Well, as I mentioned, it's a process. It's a gradual process to get the employee back to functioning at a level that pre-medical leave, for example. So if you're off work because of a bad back, and the job hardening would progressively give you heavier and heavier things to lift, for example. That's a bad example because I didn't lift anything in my job, but
it's a good example though. Yeah.
Well, depending on the type of work that you do, it's a gradual re-entry into the job. Sometimes you would start, a couple of days a week instead of a full week, and then gradually build. And it does a number of things, but primarily it's to better equip the individual to gradually take on more and more responsibility rather than just the overwhelm, which likely would happen otherwise. So I guess they have these programs because they have experience with introducing people back to work, and they found that this is the most successful type of approach. So, and I was also speaking about cognitive behavior therapy. And so when I was in my job through the job hardening, I was just feeling like, oh man, I'm just not doing this work very well, and I just don't have the brain capacity anymore, and I really should retire early and leave this job for a younger person. They would be so much more effective than I am. I just, just don't have what it takes anymore, and I've lost my mojo, and I was all these terrible negative feelings and thoughts about myself and my inadequacies. And then I remembered, or rather I realized, wow, that is just negative thinking.
Right.
And so I had an elastic band in my desk that I kept there. And so I put it on, and this is a classic thing for CBT, is you snap the elastic band, the rubber band, to kind of arrest your thinking so that the brain and the body is arrested and say, whoa, what just happened? Snap, ouch, that hurts. So it changes the brain a little bit. And then you're required to say, okay, is this the truth? Are these thoughts real reality, or are they just negative thinking? So you analyze that a little bit and you reframe these thoughts. Hey, I'm only in my second month of my job hardening program. Give me a break. Give yourself a break. You're just expected to do one thing at a time. You've just been off on this leave, so take it easy. And it works. It really, really works. It's amazing how much our brain is filled with conditioned thinking. And some of those thoughts that we have in our brain, and usually they're negative, unfortunately, a lot of these thoughts about, they come from way back, some of them, some from our growing up years, and a lot of times in our family, these are just givens, these negative thoughts that, oh, you're just not good at this, or a variety of thinking. Sometimes they've been in our family before we were even born. They're ancient thoughts, and yet we carry these things. So cognitive behavior therapy is a technique, and there's a very detailed process and a form that you can have, like a template to say, okay, on the negative side, these are my thoughts. On the positive thoughts, positive side, this is how I could reframe my thoughts. And in the middle is the reality. What is it really like? So it's a very useful program, especially successful for depression, for dealing with the thinking.
And again, the way that we think about how we think is so very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things your therapist suggested that you focus on was to do things that you enjoyed. When you're in a depressive state, it can be hard to imagine that there's anything that you enjoy. How did you find what it was that you enjoyed?
Well, what she said was, if you don't know what you enjoy because you enjoy nothing, do things that you know you used to enjoy. So that was the key. So I knew that I always liked to make things with my hands, whether it was with fabric or jewelry or leather or knitting or, you know, anything. Paper, I would always, ever since I was a child, I always made stuff with my hands. So, and I had a fully equipped sewing room down in my lower level of the house. And so I said, okay, this is your prescription, doctor said. So you have to go down there at least 30 minutes a day. And you'll remember that I'm at home and my full-time job, I felt, was to learn how to get better. And so I scheduled a minimum of 30 minutes each day to be in my sewing room and do stuff in there, whether I felt like it or not. And normally I didn't feel like it much. But I said, nope, it's on my schedule. It's written right here. Got to go down. So I would go down and I would do whatever. I mean, I always had two or three or four projects on the go from before my depression, that is. So I would just pick one of them up and do stuff. And, you know, this one day I remember, and it was, oh my gosh, those 30 minutes were the longest. It would just wouldn't end. I was not having fun. I was not having fun, but I had to stay there. And then I came upstairs and I sat in my chair and I thought, hey, I'm feeling better than I did when I went down there. Wow, I'm going to go outside for a walk. So it, even though it's almost like the emotion lags. So even though I didn't enjoy it, there was a part of my brain that benefited from it. And so, you know, the next day I went down and I was a lot more enthusiastic. I felt like, oh yeah, I can't wait to do this or that. So it built. And again, it was a gradual building of enjoyment. And one of the things that was really important during that year was every morning, as part of my meditation, I would ask my soul, what do you feel like doing today? Do you feel like going outside for a walk, maybe take the dogs for a walk? Do you feel like journaling? Do you feel like going into your creativity room? Do you feel like cooking? Do you feel like having a coffee with a friend? What do you feel like doing? And I would pick one, and I had to pick one. If I felt like doing none of the above, then I had to pick one. And I would go do that. And then I would record my mood, if you will, because that's what they call, you know, when you're in a depressive mood. I would record how I felt before I did the activity. I would go do that activity. I would come back to my journal and record, how was that? And how do I feel now? And just to show some improvement, you know, and another thing that I did in terms of feeling good and doing something that you enjoy is I started a little book called my High Five book. And I'm not sure where I got that idea, but it's not original to me. I just don't recall where I got it. And so I would write down in there anything that someone might say to me that was a compliment, or if I, you know, made something that I really loved and someone said, whoa, that is neat, I would write it down. Later, when I went back to work, if my manager said something good about my work, I would write it down. Any, you know, positive emails, and I would date it. And it helped me to capture a picture of reality. So that was a positive thing that was happening in my world. And here's the documentation. I would date it. That's the proof. And it served to convince my subconscious that I wasn't all bad. It wasn't all these negative thoughts. You know, that's not reality. That's the illness speaking. So I recognized it that way. And I said, here, look, I've proved it. It's in my High Five book. There's a date beside it. So sorry, but you're not 100% right. And so I had to challenge my subconscious all the time. And I slowly built, you know, the positivity in my life, and I began to ignore the negativity in my life, or correct the negativity in my life. It was a lot of work, a full-time job.
That's what it sounds like.
I was flying. I was really enjoying the learning. I really was. So,
you know, I was smiling as I'm listening to your explanation of all the steps and all the writing and all the thinking that you were engaged in. And it does sound like a lot of work, but what wonderful work. What powerful work. What life-changing work.
Absolutely. Transformed me into, this is going to sound a little funny, but this is how I feel inside. It transformed a weak, feeling, insecure person into a real, powerful, creative, bright light. A power. I just feel like I came into my power through that process. And I know that spirit is a very big part of that in supporting me. But today, and this is a while ago, right? We're now in 2017. That was mostly in 2010. So it's a little while ago. And I returned to work for about 6 years. And so I retired in September. But man, today, I can do anything I want. I truly believe that. I have the wherewithal. I have the confidence. I was able to build my self-esteem because I realized that, you know, when my depression healed, there was something left behind that didn't catch up with the healing, and that was my self-esteem. It was really, really weak. I felt like there was something inside of me that was still so fragile. So I was able to build that up. And I explain that very clearly in my book, how I built that up through creativity, a lot of it, and through my High Five book, you know, in demonstrating to my subconscious and also to the rest of the world, to my brain, that I was okay. That I was pretty darn good, and no one could tell me otherwise. I became so strong, like I was going to fight anybody who wanted to challenge me. So it was an amazing, amazing year of healing. It was an amazing journey. And it's just so surprising what life has in store for us sometimes. And it's a good thing we don't know that in advance because we'd run scared. But I was able to turn something that was pretty traumatic into a life-giving force.
You speak a lot about the power of spirit and taking a spiritual approach for yourself, the power of that for you. But of course, you know, there are many people for whom that doesn't resonate, being spiritual, and it just doesn't go anywhere for them. What would you say to them?
I can only speak about my own experience, Pamela. I went through real ups and downs in my spiritual quest over many decades, and I wasn't always this solid in my spirit faith. I can only say what I have learned and what I have experienced through spirituality, that I've never felt so strong before. There was always, I was always searching. There was all, I always felt there was something missing. Something wasn't quite complete until I found, you know, the deep spirit. And I hesitate to use a particular nomenclature, because I've come to know deeply that whatever the name is that we give to this greater spirit base power source, whatever that is, it's all the same source. I picture it as a lake of water, and you can't separate pieces of the water. It all blends into one, and it flows and just, you know, reaches every little crook and cranny and whatever. So if those listeners don't have that connection to spirit, you know, there's a lot. Yes, I speak a lot about spirit, because to me that really guided me. But there's a lot of exercises and, you know, different tools that I share in my book that would still be useful. There's still things that people can do. They would just have their own experience, not mine, because you can't have two identical experiences.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You spoke about a blended faith. And you also talked about a time when you became particularly concerned that your husband did not share your spiritual beliefs. And that was hard for you.
And
you speak about your husband in very warm and loving terms, but yet in this particular area, it was hard for you to reconcile what to do about this particular issue. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like to pick up with your particular journey on this particular path of trying to reconcile your concerns about where your husband was spiritually versus where you were spiritually. So we'll be back in a moment, and that's where we'll start. Folks, I'm speaking with Michelle Swiderski, who is the author of A Joyful Life, How to Use Your Creative Spirit to Manage Your Depression. We'll be right back. Michelle, when a spouse begins to have concerns about their spouse's sense of faith or spirituality, it can, in some instances, wreak havoc in the connection between the two. How did you manage your, at one point, growing concerns about the difference between your spiritual path and your husband's?
It was one of the hardest road that I had to walk. I was very close to leaving the marriage because I felt that my faith and spirituality had to be the most important thing in my life. And I felt that if my husband couldn't be on board, then how could I possibly continue in the marriage? I had a huge, very, very hard struggle with this. And we had, you know, conversations. And the interesting thing was that, so we're now celebrating 21 years of marriage. So we'd been together a good while. But the thing is that he didn't change. I changed. And so it's not as if, you know, he betrayed me in somehow and, you know, went on a different wing. He was still the same. He was still, you know, the same guy that I married. And I'm the one who was changing the rules. And so I prayed I didn't know what to do with this situation anymore because I wanted to be faithful to God. And how could I be in this marriage where he didn't share my faith? And I just prayed to God and I pleaded, you know, I said, just show me, tell me what to do. And in fact, I feel, and I'm cognizant of your listeners who may not be believers in God, but I'm just going to speak the way I would speak to a friend here. And I feel that God healed my heart and gave me the answer that I was looking for. He told me through a radio talk show, as a matter of fact, he told me very clearly that my job was not to judge Robert or to change Robert. My job here in this marriage was to love Robert just the way he is. And I thought, oh, I get it. God is using this marriage to teach me how to love fully. Because this is something that I was having difficulty with, opening my heart completely. It was hard. It was painful. And I suddenly understood. It was just like something clicked. I said, oh, that's what I'm here for. And then only like a few days later, I felt a healing directly in my heart. And then after that, I was able to completely accept our marriage for what it was. It was a really healthy, loving relationship. And so that's how it unfolded. And I just felt so thankful that I didn't act rashly. You know, I could have really jeopardized a really wonderful relationship, and thankfully I did not.
So it sounds like you're saying that the two of you did not need to be a mirror image of the other in order to walk on a healthy, loving path.
That's right. And we can have really interesting, deep, you know, philosophical discussions and be on the same page completely. It's just that I have a faith-based approach and philosophy, and he has a different approach and philosophy, but we meet in the middle. And, you know, and It also taught me that, you know, it's a personal choice that we make, but in a marriage, it's important to be your person. You don't have to imitate the other, like you said. It's maybe it's even more important to find yourself as a complete individual within this union, and to grow the way you should be growing, the way nature intended you to grow, while still in this union, and hopefully the marriage grows with you. I was lucky enough to recognize what I really had.
You were also open enough to be able to see.
True. True.
You talk about finding your purpose. And, you know, in today's world, this notion of finding one's purpose, it's almost a buzzword.
Yes.
And I'm not even sure that folks who say it know what it actually means for them. When you say that it was important for you to know your purpose, what does that mean? What did that mean for you? How did you discover your purpose?
Well, one of the things that I've read, and I've attended a number of spiritual retreats over the years, you're right, it's something that, you know, most people search for. What am I here for? And what can I give? And all of that. People will say, like the spiritual directors will often say, well, to find your purpose, sometimes you need to look to your greatest wound or your biggest weakness, and you might find your purpose there. So I started looking, and my biggest wound and area of weakness was depression. And I just thought, interesting. And then when I returned to work, I began to speak in the workplace about my experience. And I took a public speaking course, not to speak about my work, but to speak about mental health. That motivated me. That really, you know, lit the fire and say, oh my goodness, if I can speak about the importance of mental health and, you know, what to look for in terms of people's weaknesses or triggers or, you know, the anxiety, and that it's possible to get help and to have healing. It's possible to manage depression while still enjoying a happy life. Because depression, I mean, if people speak about it at all, and most of what we read, it's a pretty dark topic, clearly. But I was able to provide hope. And so I felt that my largest and biggest challenge of my life was learning to manage depression, and I just so wanted to tell the world. I wanted to share with people what I had discovered, because, you know, I've been to a number of doctors and, you know, psychologists, therapists, and there wasn't one there, like an advocate, who was able to say, okay, Michelle, I have a get well plan for you. You're going to do this, then that, and then when you finish these 10 steps, we'll reassess and see how you're doing. There was nothing like that. And so I was able to figure out my own get well plan and carry that out, and it really worked. And what I learned was that depression affects the entire person. It affects your physical body. You just don't feel like doing anything. You just want to crawl under your blankets and stay there. It affects your appetite, your sleep, your mind, right? Your thinking ability. It affects your soul, your spirit, everything. And so I learned, I found a way to address each one of those components. And I found that by addressing the whole person, I was able to become well. And the wonderful thing is that it's a lasting wellness. And as well as the right medication, it's key, in my view, that we're able to access, you know, all those components and to address each one of those components. Because the way that I maintain good health these days is by ensuring that my life is in balance. I have something, you know, in each of those areas that is healthy. I make sure that I eat well. I make sure that I sleep well. I can't skip meals. I try to get exercise. I'm not very good at that, I have to say. But anyway, I'm going to try harder to get exercise. And I make sure that I, you know, have activities in my day that nourish my spirit and my soul. I still meditate every morning. That's a way for me to connect with Source and make sure that I'm grounded. Very important for me to do that. I visualize. I use visualization a lot to visualize success, to visualize, you know, a happy day. And so that's the thing. It's there's nobody out there, it seems, that has the key, you know, to help people deal with depression. And yeah, I feel that helping people through these challenges, I do feel that it's my calling. It's something that I feel very strongly about, that I feel passionate about, helping people, but also society to open up a little bit and to acknowledge. I mean, today, more than ever, people are under such stress and strain that we need to find ways to support and to teach people how to use tools. I mean, we teach people how to be fit, you know, go to the gym, you have personal trainers, there's all kinds of websites around, you know, how to learn how to jog. And yet on the mental health front, there's a lot going on, but at the same time, there's very little going on. Very little that's easy for people to access. It seems complex, complicated, because it's a complicated illness. But I just want to talk about it, talk to people about it, and to give them hope. Because that's the key. If you have depression, you feel hopeless, you may as well call it a day. That's how it feels. You know, forget it. There is no light at the end of the tunnel. But if there is just a little bit of hope, that's just enough to keep you going.
It's just enough internal energy to help you to move forward, to begin to move forward and more forward and more forward.
Yeah, one tiny step at a time. Just do the next right thing. And that's all it takes. Which is a lot.
It's a lot, it's a little, and it's powerful.
Yes.
You mentioned medication, and you know, there are so many thoughts that folks have, pro and con, about medication. But so it was interesting to me that you brought it up as a useful tool, if it's a tool that's useful for you.
Well, you know, I spent many years without medication. So in the early years, in 2002, my doctor and I tried a whole bunch of different medications, and the side effects were so bad that I quit. I just said, no more medication, because it's crazy. One of the side effects was involuntary tremor, they called it. Well, my jaw moved as if I was freezing cold, constantly. And we took my, like, I quit the medication and everything, and the side effects still kept on going for over a year. So some of the side effects are pretty significant. And so I had decided, nope, I don't want any more drugs. Thank you very much. And then, but the last time that the third time that I was off work with depression, a number of things happened to force me to reconsider that decision. And so, and by then, there were new medications on the market. And so one of these new ones just did wonders. I like to say that it gave me back my personality dipped in sunshine. And so what a difference that made. And it made it possible for me to have better control over my thoughts. It gave me energy. You know, and it just gave me a fighting chance. So all of the other things that I was implementing in my life were still very important. Medication made it all a little bit easier. So the issue that I have with antidepressants is that too often people will go to their doctors, they get a pill, and they continue the way they always did. They don't change how they think or what they've been doing. They don't change anything to help themselves, you know? And that's when I have a problem with it, that we need to look at each of the components of our lives, because there's a reason why depression has shown up. And it's really helpful if we can take a look at those underlying causes, some of which we may or may not be able to do anything about, but at least be aware and maybe be able to turn down the volume a little bit. It will help us a lot more than just taking the pill.
Absolutely.
That's my opinion, and I think research backs that up. But I'm no longer against antidepressants, that's for sure, because of the change that it gave me back my life and my personality, that I really hadn't seen my personality fully for probably 20 years.
Wow.
And it sure was a nice reunion.
Michelle, how do folks find out more about what you're writing and what you're doing?
I am blogging, so on my blog at Michelle, M-I-C-H-E-L-E, Swiderski, S-W-I, D for David, E-R, S for Sam, K-I.com, MichelleSwiderski.com, and that's Michelle with one L. They can visit me there, and I'd love to hear from them.
Wonderful. Michelle, our time has flown by. I do want to thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Brewer. Have a wonderful day.
And you as well.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk, which is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you may choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26 by 2 Communications, and it is available to you on demand in several ways. You can always go to Mind Talk, MyndTalk.org. You can download the Mind Talk app from the iTunes Store or from Google Play, or you can subscribe to the Mind Talk podcast via iTunes. I'd love to know where in the world you're listening to Mind Talk, so send me an email to Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. You take care.